Juno reaches Jupiter this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome, I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. And what an adventure we have for you this week. Join me at JPL for the thrilling, nerve-wracking, and ultimately triumphant arrival of the Juno spacecraft on July 4th. You'll hear the tension and the celebration. Just as importantly, we'll talk with several of the men and women on the Juno team about how this was achieved and what to expect next. Our special coverage begins now.
Hey folks, if I can ask you to step this way once you get your bag, can you join the group this way?
More than 1,000 people came to the Jet Propulsion Lab on that 4th of July. They included members of the Juno team, their loved ones, young and old, a few celebrities and VIPs, and a large contingent of media reps like me. Among the VIPs was Planetary Society CEO Bill Nye. Describe the scene.
There's a lot of people here. A lot of people are here on the 4th of July. They're not home barbecuing or carrying on. They're here for the orbital insertion of the Juno spacecraft into orbit around Jupiter, and I'm invested in this mission. I was there at the launch August 5th, 2011, and it's been almost 5 years to get out to Jupiter. I did a series of videos for Scott Bolton, and I'm very excited about this. This is another thing, I got to tell you, it's all in when you count the rocket. It's over $1 billion. But that's over 5 years of flying. There's a couple more years of mission, and there were 5 or 10 years before that planning this thing. It's not that much money per year per taxpayer, and it's very reasonable that we will make discoveries that have to do with the origin of the solar system and therefore the origin of you and me, and that is exciting. Jupiter's huge. It's huge. It's very big. It's massive. Why didn't it fall into the sun? We're going to figure it out.
We got maybe, let me look at my watch.
It's 2.5 hours.
2.5 hours, the rocket starts to burn.
Yeah.
Big fun, big excitement.
Yeah. So you guys, the rocket motor has been in the icy blackness of space for 5 years. Would you go out to your car after you let it sit in the winter for 5 years and expect it to start? No, you probably wouldn't. But here at Rocket Science, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, we fully expect the thing to turn on and work just beautifully.
If you get one of those premier memberships, will the Auto Club help you out at Jupiter?
Well, I hope they're not needed. You're getting to me, Matt. I'm starting to feel the tension. It's exciting.
Not far from the JPL visitors' entrance, scores of reporters from around the world and working in every medium, including virtual reality, were camped out in the media center. Among them, no surprise, was the Planetary Society's senior editor, Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, we're about 2 hours away from either getting really tragic news or much more likely really good news. I mean, would you put it that way?
I would put it that way. That's really the only two possible outcomes that we can have today. Either it goes into orbit, and as long as it's in some orbit, they will be able to make a great mission out of this mission. And if it doesn't go into orbit, they're never coming back to Jupiter.
I'm counting on a celebration, and much of that will happen. Well, first it'll happen in Mission Control and all the other rooms all over JPL where people have gathered this evening. But then it's going to come here for the big press conference.
There's going to be a lot of media here really excited to hear the news. You know, it's funny because media are supposed to remain cool, not applaud at press conferences, but, you know, there's going to be a little celebration if they get into orbit.
So much history has happened in this facility and even in this room, Von Karman Auditorium. You've been here for a lot of it, haven't you?
I've been here for a great many pre and post launch landing arrival press briefings. I always have to pay homage to the gigantic model of Voyager that's in the back. I don't know if it's Voyager 1 or Voyager 2. It stands in for both of them. And it's really the spacecraft that kind of paved the way into the outer solar system for so many of these wonderful missions.
And still paving.
That's a good point. It's now paving the way beyond the solar system for a path for hopefully very many spacecraft to follow.
Of course, by the time people hear this, by the time I edit it, we'll know whether it was good news or bad news. But even so, give us an idea of what the spacecraft is up to now.
Well, the spacecraft is getting quite close to Jupiter. Pretty soon, it's going to have to turn away from Earth and also away from the Sun in order to point its engine in the correct direction. And that's actually, you know, a little bit of a hazard for a solar-powered spacecraft. We're not going to be able to communicate with it that easily, and it's not going to be power positive during this time. At the press briefing this morning, Scott Bolton made a big deal about how a lot of people will be celebrating if the burn ends properly, but he's not going to celebrate until those solar panels turn back toward the Sun. The spacecraft is power positive again and filling those batteries, preparing for science.
And as we've heard already from you and several other people on this show, no really great science again until August.
That's pretty much true, because most of the best science data that Juno gets is done right around closest approach. And the next time it will approach Jupiter closely is August 27th for its Perigove 1. And that will be an opportunity when they're not doing any rocket firings. All the instruments will be on and getting their proximal Jupiter data for the first time. All the scientists are really looking forward to that.
What are you going to be doing for the next two and a half hours?
I'm going to be twiddling my thumbs and probably playing with New Horizons data, because there's no data from Juno, and I might as well enjoy some outer solar system fun while I'm waiting.
Thanks, Emily. I hope we can talk to you again after a successful orbital insertion.
Me too.
Fran Bagenol is one of the hundreds of scientists eagerly awaiting the data that will stream back to Earth from Juno. She's a research scientist at the University of Colorado's Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics. Fran also leads Juno's key investigation of Jupiter's massive magnetosphere, the power behind the planet's spectacular aurora. The big day has arrived. You've been awaiting this with the rest of the team for more than 5 years, right?
Easily. We started working on this about 2003, so, yep, over a decade.
Give us the thumbnail of what you hope Juno will reveal to us about this gorgeous planet that we have not been able to learn to date.
There are three main things I want to know. I want to know what it's like in the deep interior. How is the material distributed deep down inside? Second is of the atmosphere. How much water is there? What's underneath those clouds and how is it distributed? And thirdly is what I'm really interested in, which is how does a magnetic field energize ions that then bombard the atmosphere and make the aurora. Very dramatic aurora that we see with Hubble and so on. How does that work?
Do we understand why this planet has such a powerful magnetosphere? It's been described as the largest structure in the solar system.
Jupiter has a very strong magnetic field, and that's because a large volume of this giant planet is filled with conducting material, hydrogen that is electrically conducting. So we know the magnetic field is strong, and extends a long way out away from the planet. But in addition to that, the strong magnetic field of Jupiter couples ions that are made from Io, that volcanic moon, sulfur and oxygen ions, that are accelerated to high energies at processes we don't really understand. So it also blows it up like a balloon and fills it up with very hot plasma. So yes, it's a vast region, much bigger than anything else in the solar system.
There's no shortage of planets like Jupiter as we look out across the galaxy, is there?
There are many, many exoplanets that are Jupiter size, Jupiter character. And so what we're hoping is by getting up close to Jupiter, we will learn about one planet in particular. And then maybe we can begin to generalize about how others may be variations on a theme of that planet.
You were kind enough to sit down with me here on the JPL Plaza. You were headed toward, I assume, where you're going to spend the rest of this very exciting evening. Where are you headed?
We're going to have an auditorium of about 450 people filled with friends and family of the Juno team. And we're going to be talking about Juno and following along the program and hearing, you know, how things are going and getting the update from the spacecraft team. And they'll be telling us, hopefully, that all's gone well.
As I talked with Fran Bagenol, we were approached by her friend and colleague Jonathan Nichols of the University of Leicester. Jonathan is behind the awe-inspiring images and video of Jupiter's North Pole Aurora, shot in ultraviolet over the last month by the Hubble Space Telescope. Not a coincidence, this timing of your work.
not a coincidence at all. We proposed for exactly this time, exactly when Juno was approaching Jupiter, so we get great data of the solar wind near Jupiter, and we'll be able to tell for the first time whether there is any solar wind effect on the Jovian auroras.
Absolutely spectacular images. Have we seen anything like this before from Jupiter?
We've seen great images of Jupiter's auroras before. What's different about these is that they seem really active. When you look at the images, you see things popping off, you know, all over the place. It's almost like a firework party is going off on Jupiter. And we really want to find out whether there's anything in the solar wind that's causing all that activity. And in fact, we've seen some of the brightest and most powerful auroras that we've ever seen with Hubble. So it's a great set of data, and I look forward to analyzing it over the coming months.
Almost as if the planet was rolling out the fireworks welcome carpet to mix metaphors.
Yeah, absolutely. And why not? It's a great mission. Everybody's looking forward to it. So should Jupiter.
What kinds of energies are we talking about, and how does it compare to the auroras we're so much more familiar with at our own poles?
Well, Jupiter's auroras are the brightest in the solar system. They're about 100 times brighter than the Earth's. But in fact, during this campaign, we saw them peak up to about 1,000 times.
Wow.
The power emitted by the auroras is about 1 terawatt, which is about roughly 1,000 nuclear power stations. So it's a really, really powerful system.
And needless to say, the breadth of the aurora is several Earths.
That's right. The size of the oval that you see in the images is about 3 Earths across. And, you know, that just puts it in context how awesome and powerful Jupiter's magnetic field is.
Other than it leaving us in awe, what can we learn from studying the aurora?
So the auroras are very beautiful, obviously, but what the auroras tell you is they tell you what's going on in the magnetic field, the magnetosphere surrounding the planet. And Jupiter's magnetic field, Jupiter's magnetosphere, is the largest object in the solar system. It's 5 times bigger than the Sun. It's 5 times further away than the Sun, so if you could see it in the sky, it would appear as large as the Sun in the sky. That's how awesome it is. And the auroras are a television screen that tell you about the energetic processes that's going on in the magnetic field. And learning about different planets tells you about the space environment in general. And we as a civilization are becoming more and more dependent on the space environment. We have satellites in space, we have polar communications, we have long transmission lines, power transmission lines that are all susceptible to so-called space weather. And so we need to find out as much as we can. And each planet gives a different story.
You have delivered observations of these auroras that are, I'm sure, equal to or better than anything that can be done from Earth. Yet you are still excited about what this spacecraft will tell us. How will that take place? How will it add more to our knowledge than you're able to from here?
So Juno is going to get really, really close. You know, we get great images from Hubble, but we only get one set of times that we can observe, when those auroras are facing us. We can't observe when they're around the other side, and that gives us a bias. We can only observe during a set time in the Jovian day. So Juno is going to give us those information when the auroras are on the other side of the planet. And they may look completely different. We've got no idea. But also Juno is going to be really close. It's going to get a view so close that we're going to see the aurora, see the 1,000-kilometer-high auroral curtain. And not only that, we're going to be flying through the auroral region, through the auroral magnetic field lines. We're going to be measuring those electrons as they come barreling down the field line, hit the atmosphere and make it glow. It's going to be so much fun.
You are doing a good job of communicating the passion you have for the science that's coming. Where will you be as we wait to hear that Juno has gone into orbit?
So I'm going to be nervously waiting with everybody else in one of the auditoriums. I'm going to be listening out for that signal that tells us that the main engines have cut off at the right time. We've got the right delta V, we've got the right change in velocity, and we're going to be in orbit, and that's when the fun begins.
Forgive me for early congratulations, Jonathan, but here's to wonderful science to come.
Well, thank you very much.
I headed back into the JPL Media Center and famed Von Karman Auditorium. That's where I found recent guest Candy Hansen. You may remember that Candy is the Juno co-investigator in charge of JunoCam, the people's camera carried by the spacecraft. With Candy was her close colleague, Elsa Jensen, an instrument operation engineer for JunoCam at Malin Space Science Systems, builder of the unique camera. You have in your hands I think, the best prop that anybody has brought tonight. Tell us about this.
This is our camera. This is a working, functional, form, fit, and function model of the camera. It's quite heavy because we have all the shielding on it. You know, it's not very big. We designed it so that we would get really good pictures of the poles of Jupiter. That is new territory for the spacecraft, for us. We've never had a spacecraft go over the poles of Jupiter before. And so the nice wide-angle lens that we have on JunoCam is going to allow us to get an image from limb to limb of the polar region. So we'll be looking for a vortex, a polar vortex, and what kinds of storms and all that kind of good stuff.
Looking for hexagons, maybe.
Looking for hexagons. We'll be looking for hexagons.
So this camera, it's special because of the shielding, as you said,
yes. But
it really has quite a heritage that comes from you amazing folks at Malin Space Systems who make all these incredible imagers that go out into space.
That's right. The sensor inside the JunoCam instrument is the same sensor that we have on the Curiosity rover cameras, the MASCAM, the MOLLE, the MARTI. So we're able to reuse the design of the sensor itself. And then, as Candy said, because of the harsh radiation environment around Jupiter, we shielded it. So it grew from a few hundred grams to 5 pounds.
It's all shielding.
Just like the main electronics vault, as it's called, on the spacecraft, right?
That's right. We are going into a very toxic environment, so to speak, and so everything has to be shielded.
Candy Hansen and Elsa Jensen with JunoCam. When we return, we'll relive the 35 minutes of terror as Juno screamed into Jupiter orbit. This is Planetary Radio.
This is Robert Picardo. I've been a member of the Planetary Society since my Star Trek Voyager days. You may have even heard me on several episodes of Planetary Radio. Now I'm proud to be the newest member of the Board of Directors. I'll be able to do even more to help the Society achieve its goals for space exploration across our solar system and beyond. You can join me in this exciting quest. The journey starts at planetary.org. I'll see you there.
Do you know what your favorite presidential candidate thinks about space exploration? Hi, I'm Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society's Director of Space Policy. You can learn that answer, and what all the other candidates think, at planetary.org/election2016. You know what? We could use your help. If you find anything we've missed, you can let us know. It's all at planetary.org/election2016. Thank you.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan.
Go ahead, Nav.
Yeah, we see the expected sharp shift upward and the Doppler residuals indicating the main engine has started.
Copy that. That's good news. We are still awaiting confirmation of that in the zone.
That was how we learned that Juno's main engine had started to burn exactly as planned. Controllers knew this in part because of the Doppler change in Juno's radio transmission frequency caused by the deceleration. So the engine was working, but would it burn for the full 35 minutes needed to get Juno into the right orbit? Just grabbed Emily out of the auditorium for a quick update. Where are we now?
We are in the about 10 minutes into the burn, and we don't know if it's actually continuing to be successful or not. We're waiting to hear news from Juno.
And in the meantime, everybody's really just hanging out and we're watching TV coverage from JPL.
Yeah, you know, I'm a little sad. We used to be able to get a special feed of the chatter from the mission support area, the engineering talk, and they don't provide that to us anymore. So the media here at JPL are seeing the same thing everybody at home is.
Emily Lakdawalla. Stuart Stephens of Caltech has been a key mission engineer and planner for Juno. He was also providing great commentary for NASA's webcast, including this explanation of just how close the spacecraft would come to the giant planet.
And that closest approach point, closer than no other spacecraft has ever been before, is about 2,800 miles above the cloud tops, or 4,500 kilometers. And our velocity, our speed, is 58 kilometers a second. I'll translate that for you. That's 36 miles per second, or about 130,000 miles per hour. That's the fastest we'll be going relative to Jupiter as we go right past at its closest approach point. We'll slow down a little bit as we go past that. We're continuing to slow down in general with our burn, just enough at the end of that 35-minute burn to put us into orbit.
Finally.
All stations on Juno Accord, we have the tone for burn cutoff on Delta B. Gratis domum, Juno. Welcome to Jupiter.
Burn time was 21.02 seconds, only differing 1 second off of the pre-burn predictions.
A little more than an hour later, men and women in Juno polo shirts and wearing big smiles trekked across the JPL campus from the mission support area to Von Karman Auditorium. Juno Principal Investigator Scott Bolton took the center seat on stage. Here's what he had to say when the post-orbital insertion media briefing began.
NASA did it again. That says it all to me. And I am so happy to be part of the team that did that. I mean, this team has worked so hard, and we have just such great people. And it's just it's almost like a dream coming true right here. I had to go back and get my family and drive them in here earlier this evening. And they get in the car and they've lived this. I mean, my kids are, 12 and 13, and their whole life has been Juno, basically. And I'm driving in and I said, so that's it. I just want you guys to remember there's some risk here tonight. I said, by the time we're driving back to the hotel tonight, either we're going to be in orbit or we won't. And we're in. And now the fun begins. The science.
Scott Bolton, principal investigator for the Juno mission, now orbiting Jupiter. A small bonus for you before we go to Bruce for this week's What's Up. Bill Nye couldn't make it back to the JPL Media Center from the VIP area where he had watched and celebrated with hundreds of other Juno fans. It was not long after orbital insertion was completed that I found this voicemail message from Bill and Planetary Society board member Bob Picardo, who also hosts the Society's monthly Planetary Post video newsletter.
Matt, Bill Nye here.
And Picardo.
Hey, man, this has worked.
Engine burn complete.
That's amazing. That, my friends, is rocket science. Happy Independence Day in the United States.
We are in orbit around Jupiter.
Woo! Carry on, Matt.
Time for What's Up. On this special edition of Planetary Radio, we are ready to talk by Skype with Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. Bruce, we're at Jupiter.
Congratulations. Great job, Matt.
All I did was get to talk about it and talk to some of the people who actually made it happen, but certainly great reason to celebrate.
It is indeed. So check out Jupiter. Special. There's like an orbiter there now. Jupiter's in the low in the southwest in the early evening. It's getting lower and lower. It'll get trickier to see, so embrace it now in the southwest. Brightest star-like object up there, a little brighter now that it has Juno around. In a literal sense, but not in a figurative sense. Also, swing your head, but don't hurt it. Swing your head around to the left and go to the southwestern sky, and you will see Mars fading, but still looking awfully bright and reddish, and Saturn looking yellowish, hanging out over in the southwest in the early evening. We move on to this week in space history. 1965, Mariner 4 completed the first successful flyby of Mars. And exactly 50 years later to the day, well, depending on your time zone, New Horizons completed the first successful flyby of Pluto. Hopefully the first of many, although it'll probably be a while.
Milestones in the exploration of our solar system.
Random space fact. Random space fact.
Are you in the mood, Matt?
I am now, yeah. I'm not sure what for, but I am.
Well, Juno, as we've discussed, is solar powered, and it receives less than 4% of the solar power at Jupiter as it did at Earth. Less than 1/25 the amount of sunlight, because Jupiter is about 5 times the Earth's sun distance, so 1/5 squared, 1/25 the amount of sunlight at Jupiter.
Can Can I get those solar panels on my roof here in California?
Yes, but I think you can find cheaper options.
Maybe it'd work out because I probably only need like a square yard.
Well, I'm guessing you need more than that, but yeah. It doesn't. You're pretty power hungry with all those radio show things you do.
Indeed.
All right, we move on to the trivia question, and I asked you, what is the ratio of the equatorial surface gravity of the sun compared to the Earth? So if you're on the surface, or really the photosphere of the sun before you vaporized, how much more gravity would you experience than you do at the surface of the Earth? How'd we do, Matt?
This is just a fascinating question, I think, and we got some fascinating answers. This one was the one chosen by random.org. It came from Caleb Tilges in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Like almost everybody else, he said the ratio of surface gravity of the sun to the surface gravity down here is about 28 to 1.
Indeed, 28 times the surface gravity before you vaporize. And after, you just won't notice it after.
Well, Caleb, congratulations. It appears that you have won. And we're going to send you a Planetary Radio t-shirt, a rubber Planetary Society asteroid, and a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account. You can do some astronomy of your own. Take a look at all that stuff that Bruce talks about in What's Up. We got some other fun stuff, as we always do. Martin Hijoski, whose name I usually mispronounce, he just said, heavy question, dudes. A whole bunch of people, including Clem Unger and Stephen Donaldson and Jovell Clark, they all said that once that powerful gravity well reaches Earth's orbit, it's only about, this surprised me, 0.0006G, or 6/10,000ths of a G. Clem said, doesn't sound like a lot, but I guess it's enough to keep our planet in its orbit.
It is indeed. Yeah, that gravity thing, it falls off just like we were discussing with sunlight. Falls off as 1 over r squared, so 1 over distance squared drops off pretty quickly.
I love the inverse square law. Joe Murray in Hoboken, New Jersey, he suspects that even Superman would find that gravity well difficult. Joe, that just shows how little you know about Superman. He's super. And you must be thinking of the other guy, you know, Bruce Wayne's alter ego. Oh, I wasn't supposed to say that. Finally, Earl Green, Alma, Arkansas. Going by that ratio, he says, I would weigh as much as an RV as I plummet through the photosphere. So I hope that's an RV with some really good sunshades. I thought you'd like that one.
I did very much. All right, you ready for another one?
I sure am.
Keeping the Juno theme, what instrument on Juno sounds the most like it is from a Star Wars movie? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
I love it. That's intriguing. I like that one a lot. You have until the 19th, that'd be July 19, at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer. Get a load of these prizes. You ready?
I'm ready.
A Juno Mission t-shirt.
Awesome.
I'm afraid we only have a large, but also an official Juno Mission pin.
A Juno Mission head?
Pin head. No. Not a pinhead, a Juno Mission pin.
Makes a lot more sense.
We are done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky. Think about tape measures. Thank you and good night.
I love tape measures. They remind me of light sales. Slightly inside joke. Not very. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us each week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its happy members. Danielle Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed the theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.